Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
The Beatles. Magical Mystery Tour. And that was released as the title track to a six-song double EP, the first ever released in the UK on the 8th of December in 67. And it retailed at the sub-£1 price of 19 shillings and 6 pence. That was the equivalent, would you believe, to £17 today.
Wow.
That's really expensive. And because EPs weren't popular in the United States, the double EP was stretched to an LP. That's what they did, and added 5 songs that were previously released as singles, which of course upset the band, because what Lennon told Rolling Stone in an interview, you see, it's not an album. It turned into an album over here, but it was just meant to be the music from the film.
Well, you see, I didn't know that, because we have the record. We have the vinyl, the 12-inch LP, which is obviously the American pressing, and that is why I think we've got a bit of confusion with the singles.
Yeah.
Right? Which is, you know, it's very obvious. But I didn't know that. And I didn't know it was a double EP.
No.
It's the first time, so that's an absolutely new bit of information for me,
sweet,
darling.
Isn't it?
Well done.
Woohoo!
And, you know, the thing about this record is that, and I've said this on the last show, I actually think that, you know, Sgt. Pepper is not my favourite record. I think there are tracks from this LP, the American version, which are superior. And I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, it attracts me more. I don't know what it is. I mean, the film's very odd. You know, we haven't seen it for a long time, but it's very odd. And just the first thing that I've got to say about this, talking about the musicality of it all,
is the bass.
Is the bass? It's again a pick.
How did you? I didn't know you were going to say that, by the way. But that's what I thought after listening to it. Then
it's
I thought
a pick.
The bass is actually pretty beautiful, you know.
And it's a pick, and because there's some bits in it you can't play with your fingers, well, you can't get that attack, because what a pick has, it has a flexion, in other words, when you hit the string, especially with flat wound strings, the old-fashioned strings that you use, it goes boom, boom, boop, but it's got a click at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a lovely line. The other thing is, it never ceases to amaze me, the variation of drum sounds that Ken Scott and, of course, the mighty Jeff Emmerich, because Jeff Emmerich, I think, produced or engineered, should say, quite a bit of this, and some of it was Ken Scott. But the drums vary on every track of the Beatles. And there they're quite laid back in this little bit of a poppy kick. It's not like really, it's not really up front and the drum. But I listen to all this stuff and it's absolutely great. And I think Lennon's voice on that is great. It's a great song. And the last musical thing I just want to talk about here is the blasted, the arrangement of the horns. Because there's a bit that goes, and it must have been a nightmare. And I don't know, was it a French horn or is it a trumpet? I don't know, but it's going, blah, blah, blah.
They hadn't even finished the song. The brass section went into this session just a week after they finished the Sgt. Pepper sessions, and they were so disorganised. They didn't have a score, anything.
Wow.
So one of the guys who was playing in the horn section actually decided to take matters into his own hands, and I think, and did the arrangement and stuff. So
is that right?
Yeah. So...
Right, so he didn't do it. No. The man himself, did not arrange the...
I think it was a guy, Elgar Howarth.
Blimey.
Because you got Mal Evans and Neil Aspinall on percussion.
Yeah, and, which were the roadies, I think, weren't they?
Yeah, I remember that. And what's really lovely as well, one other thing about this track is the sound effect.
Right.
Of... The final mix is the sound of the Bedford Val 14 Plaxton coach registration URO913E that was hired by the Beatles for the film. And if you can hear, the sound of screeching tyres in the recording, and that's basically Ringo Starr taking it for a spin around RAF West Malling at high speed.
Thank you. The Kinks, of course. What other than Waterloo Sunset, released as a single on the 5th of May 1967, and also featured on their first studio album, Something Else by The Kinks, released 5 months later on the Pi record label. That's not Pi as in Blueberry Pie, but Pi as in P-Y-E, and produced by Shel Tamy, or co-produced with Ray Davies. Now, these are not in the notes. I've just had a quick look. Shel Tamy, of course, produced My Generation by The Who.
Yes.
Oh, I see. You've done it already. You've actually
No, I noted it, but I decided that I wasn't going to put it in.
Oh, right. And also, you produced Cat Stevens.
Okay,
know that.
Five points.
Okay.
You can have that one.
I think it's 8 points to Gryffindor.
So what is it about Ray Davies then? Because that's the first time I've really just sat very, very still and listened to that song, and it's quite beautiful.
It really... In terms of, you know, last week we talked, if you go in San Francisco, we played that.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that is probably the American version of this in a funny sort of way. And the Kinks were marvellous songwriters. And, I mean, they've written massive hits. And they just completely sort of just went out of favour. And it was, and Ray Davies is always around. And he's such a legend. You know, I mean, he finished the 2012 Olympics with this song.
I know, but it's weird, though. It's weird. Do you know I've seen him live?
Not another. No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Bridgewater Hall, Manchester.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But actually, it was weird, though, because you know when you see somebody and you don't really know their legacy, people walk on. It's a bit like when you see David Essex. I know, I saw him as well. It was a freebie. But when you see these people, I know. But the thing is that, you know, I love to see concerts because I learn from them. I like to see, I watch people and I like to see what they, how they enjoy. And what people change when they get together in a room with music and musicians.
Absolutely.
And it's, to this day, it still fascinates me, you know. But they say with that song with Ray, though, he's like, it was possibly the most beautiful song of the rock and roll era.
Well, you know, and what you instantly know what that track is as soon as the first couple of notes come up.
Yeah.
Because Dave Davies, with that guitar, I'm not exactly sure what he's using, though, but he's definitely using a tape echo on a very, very fast repeat. It's like a doubling effect, an ADT that was all the rage after the Beatles used it, of course. And automatic double tracking, that's what it stands for. And it basically means that there's a note repeated just after the original.
Yeah.
And you do it by either doing it on a tape machine by varying the speed and the head distance between the play and the record, or you use an echo. Like we have our tape echo record player.
It's like a box of magic.
It is.
It's funny because Ray actually says that guitar solo, he says that's when the magic happens, because I know people have covered it quite a bit, that song.
Yeah.
And if you picture the time, and this is one thing I keep trying to go back to, it's 1967, it's spring. You've got songs like A Wider Shade of Pale from Procol Harum, and you've got Strawberry Fields Forever, and Waterloo Sunset just fitted perfectly into that ethos of that time, and it went to number two in the UK singles charts, and it was kept off the number one spot by Silence Is Golden.
Well, I can tell you, that is, we've played that on the show, I don't think we have,
no.
It's coming up, I think,
in
the next couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm telling you now, that song is, I just love that song. So it was, it might have been kept off the top spot, but it was by a worthy adversary, I think.
Emily tries, but misunderstands. She's often inclined to borrow somebody's dreams till tomorrow. There is no other day. Let's try it another way. You'll lose your mind and play. Free games for play. See Emily play. Soon after dark, Emily cries. Gazing through trees in sorrow, hardly a sound till tomorrow. Yeah. a gown that touches the ground. Float on a river forever and ever, Emily.
Emily.
There is no other day. Let's try it another way. You'll lose your mind and play. Three games for me. See Emily play.
Pink. Floyd.
Yeah.
See Emily Play, and that was released as their second single on the 6th of June in 1967 on the Columbia label in the UK and Tower in the US. And it was initially thought to be a non-album single, but was later included as the opening track of the American edition of their debut album, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, released that year. And it reached number 6 when it was a single in the UK singles charts.
Yeah. Amazing. Written by original frontman Syd Barrett.
Yep.
And produced by Norman Smith.
Norman.
Now, I don't really know anything about Norman Smith, but Norman Smith, of course, was the first engineer that worked with the Beatles.
I remember him.
Jeff Emerick, that's yes. Right. Then he went on to work on Barclay James Harvest. He went to work on this, of course, Piper Gets Dawn and the early Pink Floyd stuff. And then, in his own right, he had success with the pseudonym Hurricane Smith. If you remember, oh, baby, what would you say? So, now I've really got her this
you
time.
Have.
I've got her in a terrifying knowledge grip.
Yeah.
I'm wrestling on the floor. Oh, ha, ha, ha. Take that.
Okay, then. And it was recorded at Sound Technique Studios.
Yes.
And, of course, it was founded by recording engineers Jeff Frost and John Wood.
John Wood, who did the audio design, the internal design of the Chairworks, where we recorded some stuff.
I knew there was a connection. And, right, I'll give you that one.
And he
I
has worked
remember.
With Andy Seward, our producer friend who produced The Knife, the Sex Solo, solo album, and has worked with us on bass before you
I know.
Took over.
I know. How funny is that, eh? But I didn't realise with the studio as well, and I've said it once this show, that like many of the folk rock acts signed to Joe Boyd's Witch Season publishing company recorded at Sound Techniques. So you have people like Fairport Convention, Nick Drake and John Martin recording their albums there in the late 60s.
Well, if you remember, we had a Nick Drake to track it. It was quite a few months ago now. But he did just an acoustic version and just vocal guitar. And it was just unbelievable. The sound was great. And these guys built their own console. That Sound Techniques was one of their own designs, you know, the console. So, and that sounds a great sounding record. It's very, very 60s, isn't it? But again, it's got that something that's quite muted and quite dirty and what's the word? Dark?
I thought that. It's like that. There is a darkness to
it. Yeah, definitely. And I think because Syd Barrett was going through a lot of problems at the time, wasn't he? And I think Dave Gilmour did say that during these sessions, it was the last time that he saw Syd Barrett write, and then he changed during these sessions. Is that right?
Well, it's kind of, no, Syd invited him down, but Syd appeared not to recognise who he was
right.
when he turned up. So Dave wasn't in the band then, and I was I was looking at the chronology because this year is really important for Pink Floyd because the Pink Floyd I know is really post-Syd Barrett, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
And so if you listen to this in terms of it's what's happened, 10th of March, 67, you've got their debut single, Arnold Lane, released in the UK. It went to number 20 in the charts. But it was the song was banned by BBC Radio London because they objected to the lyrics about a transvestite underwear thief.
No.
Yeah. So that's the 10th of March. The 21st of March, they went to record in Studio 3 at Abbey Road, and that's when they met the Beatles, who were recording Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah.
Then on the 29th of May, Pink Floyd supported Cream and the Jimi Hendrix Experience at the Tulip Bulb Auction Hall.
I've just read about that in the book, the Cream book, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So, and this is it, 22nd of December, 67, Pink Floyd played their final gig as a four-piece with Syd at London's Olympia Exhibition Hall as part of the Christmas on Earth Continued Festival. And the following month, Dave Gilmour started playing with them.
Very sad what happened to, you know, to Syd. Very,
very
sad.
It's odd, you know, and I'm a bit cross as well with the way that the music industry is sometimes, especially the TV shows. I was watching them play when they travelled with Sid, when they went to America.
Yeah.
The inane questioning of these TV presenters. So, what, you've been here for 2 days. What have you had to eat?
Well, no.
We've had a... and Roger Waters said, we've had 2 burgers.
Well,
but what do you expect? I mean, this is Pink, excuse my French, Floyd being asked what they've had to eat after just playing 2 songs on a live TV show. I mean, get a life.
I think, with Floyd, though, it's like nobody knew what was going to happen. You know, nobody knew that they were going to do Metal. Because when that came out, it just blew everything away, you know. Booker T and the MGs, of course. Hip Hugger. Hib Hug Her. The title track of their 5th album, released in June 1967 on Stax Records. Of course, you can hear it. It stinks of Stax authenticity, that song. It's the band's most successful single since their debut, Green Onions. There we are.
Yeah, it was 5 years before.
5 years before, yeah. That's right. And last been produced by Stax co-founder Jim Stewart as the band started producing their own records. And on this, of course, the introduction of Donald Duck Dunn, who replaced original bassist Lewis Steinberg in 65, and had the galvanising effect on the group's bottom end. Well, there you are.
I know. Who were?
So it was Dunn's bass, not Booker T's organ, that was driving, you know, the sound of this record. Dunn, of course, one of the great bass players of all time. I always consider him, he's like a white James Jameson.
Yeah.
Busy, quite busy in a lot of the times, you know, but he's got a very, you know, it's odd in the fact that they were both amazing bass players, but just a different thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like James Jameson was very soul-y and very smooth and slinky and, you know, a lot of notes, but Duck was more punchy and sort of more, almost British in his playing, if you know what I mean.
I don't know what it is, but there's some, I know, I can't enunciate it, I don't know how to describe it, but But you say he's busy, and yet for me there's a clarity where he's not overly busy like Jameson. He feels like what he's playing is what's needed to play. It feels like he cut through a lot. He didn't sort of overperform.
Yeah, I think probably when he was playing, I think I'm referring more to when he was playing in more backing bands, because of course Booker T and the MGs were the Stax house band, and
they played
with everybody.
That, though?
Yeah, woo! I mean they played with everybody, and. They were, in fact, they played at the Monterey Pop Festival, playing their own set, and then backing, of course, the late, great Otis Redding, alongside performers like Jimi Hendrix, Joplin, Janis Joplin, The Who, and Jefferson Airplane. And that band were each one of the members are fantastic. I mean, the Colonel, Steve Cropper, I don't actually like his guitar playing. I think it's a bit sort of kind of with his solos, but it's him. And he's very groovy. That's the thing. He's got something that nobody else can do. It's like, you know, It's like a Waterloo Sunset thing. You can instantly tell that's David Davis, and this is not the politician David Davis, of course, but this is, you know, this is a very distinctive sound. And of course, Booker T's, keyboards and organ, Hammond is amazing. It always sounds like him.
Well, they were the first because they had two white members. They were one of the first racially integrated rock groups at the time. Because when soul music and the Memphis music scene in particular were generally considered the preserve of the black culture. So they couldn't play in some places because they had a mixed race band.
Band. Well, I know it caused a lot of consternation when they were back in Otis Redding, because it was like a very odd thing.
Isn't it interesting that they've got like, it's a black band and they've got white players coming in as opposed to the other way around?
Yeah, and also, just going back to the recording techniques, I mean, you listen to See Emma Play, which is, bear in mind, they're all recorded the same year, they were still in 1967.
Yeah.
And, they're so different. The See Emma Play, it sounded dark, it sounded a bit dirty, the recording was great, but it didn't sound great. This sounds great.
All my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. Taxi's waiting, he's blowing his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could cry. So for me, tell me that you'll wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. I'm leaving on a jet plane, I don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. There's so many times I've let you down, so many times I've played around. I tell you now, they don't mean a thing. Every place I go, I think of you. Every song I sing for you. When I come back, I'll wear your wedding ring. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. I'm a leaving on a jet plane, I don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. Now the time has come to leave you. One more time, let me kiss you. Then close your eyes, I'll be on my way. Dream about the days to come when I won't have to leave alone. About the time I won't have to say. Go.
Peter, Paul and Mary. That was Leaving on a Jet Plane from their seventh studio recording, Album 1700, released on the 4th of August in 1967 on Warner Brother Records. It was the band's most successful and sadly final hit, but it was written by John Denver.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, we love John Denver. He's such a cool, kick-ass songwriter.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote, you know... He always looked like the Milky Bar kid for me, of course. Yeah. You know, from you know, I'm probably sure I'm the edge of it there, but you remember, no, can't get around me.
Yeah.
But you know, he was a marvelous singer and songwriter. You know, he wrote to me, and a great story, you know, about him. But back to Peter
yeah, so he wrote the song, and it was on his album in 1966 called John Denver Sings. But it was originally called Babe, I Hate to Go, but his producer Milt Oaken. Convinced him to change the title. Now, right. Peter, Paul and Mary, by the way, was the first ever song I recorded on a tape machine.
No.
Yeah, I was. It was Christmas time. I was with my brother-in-law at the time, then Nick Stevens.
Yeah.
And he had a, and he said, "I'd like you to sing this song." So we set up, like, we had a little recording session in the living room, and he got me to sing this song.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? So it kind of brought me back. I was like, I was very nervous, you know, as you are when you're a teenager. You just kind of think, or late teens, you're like, what are you doing?
Well,
but anyway.
As soon as you get a microphone in front of you, everything changes, doesn't it?
I know, it,
it
does. Oh, my goodness. But let's look at this band, right? So they Peter, Paul and Mary, over their career, they won five Grammys.
Bloody hell.
They produced 13 top 40 hits. Six of those hit the top 10, as well as they sold 8 gold and 5 platinum albums. I mean, these guys were huge at the time. And they were created by a guy called Albert Grossman, who was also their manager. And they formed in New York City in 1961 during the American folk music revival phenomenon. So
yeah.
they were an audition band.
Albert Grossman, of course, the manager of Bob Dylan.
Really?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a coffee.
Do you know what? My memory's terrible.
No, it's right, yeah. He died in 86, I think. But he was the manager of Bob Dylan for quite a long time.
What they say as well is that, so Peter, Paul and Mary's self-titled 62 debut album was received as a stunning oasis of content in a sea of musical fluff. I love that.
Well, you know... This is the last single,
yeah.
And unfortunately, the double bass is slightly flat at the piano. Don't you notice that? It's teeth grindingly flat. It's only a tiny bit, but definitely flat. And the only thing I'd say about this is that the vocals are too managed. It sounds like, okay, well, you know, we need to back off in the verse here and really sound sort of deep and all that. And then you can open up in the chorus with the, you know, a bit more volume. That it doesn't sound as though it's
natural.
Been natural sung, you know.
I thought that too, because I sort of got transported into the studio with her at some point and I could hear her breathing before starting a sentence, and it all just felt a little... And then I thought, oh my goodness, there's no drums. And then you just kind of focus more on the actual delivery of the vocals, don't you? And they do feel controlled. You're right.
Well, they do. And you know, but because actually the tone of the voices are nice. You know,
yeah.
Obviously, they were massively successful.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was definitely, to me, overmanaged, you know.
All day. got people who've been working for 50 years. No one asks for more money, cause nobody cares, even though they're pretty low and their rent's in arrears. Matthew and Sam. Matthew and Sam. Matthew and Sam. Matthew and Sam. And they've been working all day, all day, all day.
Stevens, a.k.a. Yusuf Islam, not Yusuf, as it says on Spotify, removed, I think, for some sort of religious reason or probably, I don't know, it makes me sick, but it's Yusuf Islam, Proud, Matthew and Son, the title track from his debut album, released on the 10th of March 1967, again on the Durham record label, the same label as the Magnificent Moody Blues.
Yay!
Peaked at number 7 in the UK album charts and released a single on the 30th of December in 66, where it remains to this day the highest performing song, peaking at number 2 in the UK singles charts. What a great song, and what a great bass with a pick.
Will you stop doing this? Pick, I am not going to play bass with a pick.
Darling, I'm afraid I'm gonna buy you one, a big one, a big pick.
Unless you want to super glue the thing onto my finger.
Well, we're going to have to. I think that's it. I think we're going to have to super glue it on. I think it's one thing. But anyway.
If I decide to emotionally express myself with a pick and a bass, I shall get one when you're not looking and I will decide. But at the moment, my expression is short scale and
telling
Mike
Mrs.
Love
Campbell
and
what
a
to
Fender
do.
Precision bass. Step away from the low end.
Telling Mrs. Campbell what to do.
Yes. It doesn't work, does it?
No, no. It doesn't. Anyway, that's right,
fine.
Back to Cat Stevens.
Yes, Cat Stevens. Now, he's a bit of an enigma, really, isn't he?
He's, well, you know, Father and Son, you know, a lot. I've got two or three of his albums on vinyl. Magnificent, you know. I love his songwriting. I love his voice, his guitar playing. I saw him on Later with Jules Holland a few years ago now, and he was just there with his acoustic guitar on his own, and he just captivated me. He just got me, you know.
Yeah.
Just got me. Because he still can do it. He's still got a great voice. The songs stand up, you know. And he didn't just write songs for himself. He wrote songs for other people, and you know.
Yeah, he wrote, like, the first colour's the deepest.
I can't believe that.
That's
know?
Crazy, isn't it?
Incredible.
I mean, I was trying to just work out, because he was signed as a teenager as a singer-songwriter. And he was inspired to start writing by Skiffle, but obviously, you know, he was, like, performing with quite elaborate arrangements, and it's not at all Skiffle. And it's just, when he changed his name, and he what happened was he got ill and he had to spend months in hospital.
Mm.
And he just had a look at his life, you know. And I think his lyrics really became more profound. I think that was before, actually, he changed his name. I think he just took a deeper direction with his actual songwriting after facing death, probably, and just, you know, his incapacity, his physical incapacity. I think it really kind of shook him up and made him look at what was important. And and he's, in a way, you know, I wish everyone would want that, you know, because you never want to say it's too late, do you? You never want to say, I wish I had, when you realise something. So it's lovely that he managed to translate a really terrible physical situation into something that he used for beauty afterwards, isn't he? And he took time out of music for a while, got married, raised a family. And, you know, so, I mean, this is a real guy.
Yeah, he is. He's great.
He's a human being.
Interestingly, on that song as well, because you know that keyboard part? I mean, that is, as soon as it comes, da 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 da, that's Nicky Hopkins, who played also with the Kinks earlier on
really?
Waterloo Sunset, yeah.
Oh.
So obviously, him and John Paul Jones were hot session guys at the time. They were the hot stuff, you know,
right.
before Led Zeppelin.
Rubber band, there's a rubber band that plays tunes out of tune in the library garden Sunday afternoon. while a little chappy waves a golden wand. Rubber band. In 1910 I was so handsome and so strong. My moustache was stiffly waxed and 1 foot long. And I loved a girl while you played tea time tunes. Dear rubber band, you're playing my tune out of tune. Oh. Rubber band, won't you play your haunting theme again to me? While I eat my scones and drink my cup of tea. The sun is warm, but it's a lonely afternoon. Rubber band, how I wish that I could join your rubber band. We could play in lively parks throughout the land. And one Sunday afternoon I'd find my love. Rubber band. In the 1418 war I went to sea. Thought my Sunday love was waiting home for me. And now she's married to the leader of your band.
Believe it or not, that's David Bowie and a song called Rubber Band from his self-titled debut album, David Bowie, released on the 1st of June in 1967 on Darren Records, recorded at Decca Studios, produced by Mike Vernon.
Again.
I know.
Engineered by Gus Dudgeon and on guitar, sitar and banjo, big Jim Sullivan.
Oh, yeah. Get in there.
Yeah, my mentor there.
You hear that? That whole start to hit, this album's like a mishmash, isn't it? Because he didn't know. Bowie said himself, he said, the album seems to have its roots all over the place in rock and vaudeville and music hall. I didn't know if I was Max Miller or Elvis Presley.
Yeah, and you know, his voice though, you know, he can still hear that tone in his voice and that style sometimes coming out in his later work.
Mm.
You know, that sort of very London sounding vocal The construction of the song is always of interest to me with David Bowie because it is different. It's not like Waterloo Sunset by the Kinks. It's quite, you know what I mean? Because Waterloo Sunset, it's like, it's a three-chord, four-chord trick. This is more complex, you know? And his music was always more complex, David Bowie, in his writing style, I think. And it is remarkable how he moved on, but it was only really when he started working with Tony Visconti, you know, later on that things started to happen.
Well, you know, this album and all his singles, he didn't release another album for 2 years. It was commercial failure and he lost his record contract in 68.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this guy, let's listen out. Everyone remembers David at the end, you know, and like gloriously triumphant. But look at what he went through to get there.
Gladys Knight and the Pips. I heard it through the grapevine. Their fourth single from Motown Records, released in 1967 September. But on Motown, that stinks of James Jameson. But they said they were trying to emulate the Muscle Shoals rhythm section. But that's definitely James Jameson.
It is.
He's all over the place.
I know. Do you know what? It was really weird, right? Because I was listening to it and I thought, hang on a minute. That's James Jameson playing.
It certainly is.
And you know what? I'm so excited about that because I'm starting to understand and recognise other bass players now by their playing.
Yeah, well.
I feel like I'm growing up, and, you know?
And the fact that we've had Duck Dunn and James, and I didn't realise.
Two of the greats.
Yeah, that's right. On here.
Gladys. But, what a great name, by the way. Gladys. Love that name.
Can't argue with that.
Yeah. So she's really highly, highly talented. You know, she won a talent competition on TV when she was seven.
Well, you know, I mean, she's one of these legends, like, you know, with Dionne Warwick and all these people that are great big stinking cheeses of the musical
world. Multiple Grammy Award winners and American Music Awards. They're from Atlanta, Georgia. And Berry Gordy from Motown wanted to sign them, you know, and she actually was like, no, I don't think so, because she didn't want to play second fiddle. Because remember, when you get signed, if you've got major artists on the label, like he had at the time Diana Ross and the Supremes, Marvin Gaye and the Temptations, you know, if you get signed to that kind of massive label, she was saying, you know, but are you just, and for what, she didn't, she signed in 66, she decided to, but it was like she didn't want to play second fiddle. And they did get the dregs of the songs, and this is the song that turned it all around for them. And to that date, it was the biggest selling Motown single that they ever had, which is fantastic for them because it made them an A-lister on the roster for the band, really.
Thank you.
The Yardbirds, White Summer, released as a single on the 24th of July 1967 on Epic Records. It was also released on their fourth and last album, Little Games, released the same month, recorded at Delaney Studios in London, UK, and produced by Mickey Most.
And on guitar, Jimmy Page.
Jimmy.
Or was it Bert Jansch? Or was it Davy Graham? Because they're all the same song. This is like Zoolander. It's all the same look. Is it La Tigra? Is it Magnum? No.
Blue
it's
Steel.
All the same. Is it Blue? Oh, don't mention Blue Steel. And that, of course, is in Dadgad, which is a special guitar tuning, which I use quite a lot. When I first started to learn Led Zeppelin songs, I tried to emulate Jimmy Page's guitar using standard tuning, which is impossible. Anyway.
Well, no one told you, did they?
No,
they
told me.
Changed
there was
tunings.
No YouTube then or anything to actually look at. But the interesting thing is that Bert Jansch's Black Mountain side has got that very similar thing, all those pull-offs and stuff, you know? And this was basically made around She Moved Through the Fair.
Can you hear that, though? It's like this Irish folk song, isn't it?
Yeah, the 1963 version by David Graham. It's got that sound to it. But all those pull-offs, and I love all that Benidorm, that on that bottom E. Well, it's D, that's the tune down. And, you know, but you-bong, beautiful, you know. And the groove of the tablas really make it work. And it's an unknown oboe player was playing on there, which I think is quite bizarre.
Yeah.
You know, and I think from a production point of view, not wishing to get too technical here, but I think it would have sounded better with a chanter. You know, it looked like a bagpipe chanter, just the actual thing that goes...
Like the instrument from Valencia.
The very one, yeah. I think it would sound really nice with that. Anyway, that's something completely separate. But Jimmy was the only band member to perform on this recording from the Yardbirds, because, I mean, he was a legendary session guitar player by then, of course.
Yeah.
And he really, you know, benefited by being in the Yardbirds, as did Jeff Beck at the time, etc. And it's just a great piece. And it really shows Jimmy Page's versatility, because I love his acoustic playing, you know. And I love that it's obviously a J45, which I think he probably borrowed again from Big Jim Sullivan. He didn't own an acoustic guitar at the time. But they are. So that is my take on it. I think it's a great song. But, you know, it's a mishmash of all these other things. And he's a chief plagiarizer, isn't he, Page?
Well, it's really, like, funny. When you look at the context of 1967, most of the rock audiences were beginning to shift from buying singles. They were more into albums, you know, and going to live gigs. And at that time, the Yardbirds were touring a lot in the US, you know, and they started to like experiment. And so they were playing like counterculture venues like the Fillmore.
Mm.
And so they were kind of there's like the Dazed and Confused. You've got the White Summer we've just played. They were playing the Velvet Undergrounds and Waiting for the Man. And they were doing like reworked versions of Smokestack Lightning and stuff. But when Mickey Most came in, EMI wanted them to produce more commercially.
Yeah.
Viable songs, but Mickey Most wasn't up to date with what was going on, even though, and Page had worked with him in sessions before, but that, I think, was like the ringing bell of the demise of the band, really, because they didn't connect, and he disconnected them from themselves. Who they were live is not what he recorded, if you know what I mean.
And it was interesting, because then, of course, when they demised, Led Zeppelin took over, you
indeed,
know, in a magnificent way. End of the show. See you next week.
Share all the love. that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be scared.